Perhaps it's a detail at this point, but it certainly is an important one. Wisconsin gunman Wade Michael Page, we learned yesterday, died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound at the scene of the shooting at that Sikh temple in Oak Creek, Wisconsin. Originally, it was thought he died of gunshot wounds from officers firing on him, as Page killed six worshippers and wounded three others, including a police officer, on Sunday. His motives died with him, and the question of whether he intended to kill himself may be related to the possibility he felt he was on some white supremacist mission. His links to extremist groups don't make him part of some conspiracy, but they might suggest that Page himself believed he was carrying out a mission that might have predated his humiliating discharge from the U.S. Army in the 1990s. Matthew Kennard has investigated the possible crossover between military service and affiliation with hate groups. He's the author of Irregular Army, How the U.S. Military Recruited Neo-Nazis, Gang Members, and Criminals to Fight the War on Terror. His book hits stores next month. Matthew, welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Let's talk first and make very, very clear that the period of time that Mr. Page was in the U.S. Army predates the period that was the focus of most of your investigation. I mean, it predates the War on Terror. Set Page's experience in the Army and what we've subsequently come to learn about him in context with your own investigations.
Sure. Well, I focused mainly on the War on Terror period, but the 1990s was a period also where there was big problems with this. Although, the interesting thing about Page is that he was serving from 1992 to 1998. The latter part of that period was supposedly a period when the U.S. military was coming down hard on white supremacists and neo-Nazis. There was a case at Fort Bragg in 1995 where a neo-Nazi paratrooper called James Burmeister killed an African-American couple. In the aftermath of that, the resulting trial and the resulting media coverage was very embarrassing for the military. So they basically changed the regulations or tightened up the regulations. As well, in 1995, obviously, Timothy McVeigh, who served in the first Gulf War, he detonated his bomb in Oklahoma. So the military, during that period when Page was, according to Stars and Stripes, serving openly, was apparently strict on white supremacists, as we have seen that narrative is now under a lot of question. What is certainly true is that during the War on Terror, when they couldn't meet troop needs, I mean, in 2005, they missed their recruitment targets by the largest margin since 1979, when the U.S. was still afflicted with what is called Vietnam Syndrome, which put many people off the military. So in order to keep up troop numbers, they changed regulations on all sorts of things. That includes criminals, overweight people, people with low IQs. They did some of that explicitly, the stuff that was less shocking to the American public, like people with low IQs and overweight people. But by stealth, they also changed regulations and stopped enforcing the regulations that did exist on people like Page, neo-Nazis, white supremacists. I spent 2 years investigating this, and I talked to many far-right leaders in the U.S. as well as veterans who basically said we were allowed to serve openly. There was no problem with having swastikas on our body. There was no our command structure knew what was going on. So, I mean, it was endemic during the War on Terror. I mean, it existed in the 1990s, but it really took off during the War on Terror.
And let's focus on the 1990s before we move on to the laxness that you describe and that you've investigated in your book, Irregular Army. I mean, in the 1990s, yeah, you've got the period of the rise of Colin Powell. You've got the reputation of the military, not only the Army, but the other services as well, as being among the most integrated, socially, cohesive institutions in the United States. How does that square with the idea that individuals who were openly affiliated with the white supremacist groups, how could they function in an institution like the Army, Navy, Marine Corps, and Air Force back in the 90s?
Well, I think your question answers itself in some ways, because I think that narrative is false. I think that this nice idea that it was a nice integrated society where everyone could express themselves, black people, gay people, is a lie. I mean, it's interesting reading friends of Page's who served with him in the 1990s. They said he was explicit about his white supremacism and neo-Nazism, even while he was serving. And I mean, he wasn't any rookie private either. He was assigned as part of the psychological operations team, which is PsyCops, which is quite an esteemed branch of the army. So, I mean, the idea that this was some wonderland where anyone could serve and it openly, I just don't believe it.
So there was no reason for Page to conceal his views, even in the army, that the triggers, whatever they were in place, didn't necessarily include saying something that would indicate an affiliation with a white supremacist group.
No, exactly. And I mean, he was riddled with white supremacist and neo-Nazi tattoos. I mean, that's how they first identified that it was a white power terrorist attack. The police, I mean, I suspect he probably had some of those tattoos when he was serving in the military in the 1990s. And I mean, for recruiters, a tattoo is usually the best way to find out about a potential soldier's far-right inclinations because they can't hide it. I mean, there is actually regulation on that, but during the War on Terror, that fell by the wayside, and it seems during the 1990s it wasn't being enforced either.
Well, on that. Would a recruiter ask someone to take off their shirt and show their tattoos?
Right. You have to. Basically, when you enlist in the military, if you have tattoos which are suspect, i.e. SS bolts, which are famous neo-Nazi insignia, or a swastika, etc., the recruiter will ask you to explain why you have that. I mean, and some recruiters can, if you explain that you like the way a swastika looks, they'll let you go through. It's very ambiguous. And also there's also the option that you can modify that tattoo. I mean, I heard of an example of a soldier being told by the recruiter to modify their tattoo. So he changed the swastika into a sun wheel and was sent off to Iraq. So, I mean, basically the US military has never been unambiguous in their regulation on neo-Nazi white supremacists, precisely because in times of chronic troop needs, like the War on Terror, they need wiggle room so they can retain these
people.
They need the troops.
Matthew, what changed after the war in Afghanistan and Iraq got going?
Well, I mean, the simple thesis is that the U.S. military just didn't have enough troops to populate two occupations in the Middle East, so they turned to changing regulations on lots of different groups, some explicitly and some by stealth. Neo-Nazis and white supremacists obviously was by stealth because the population, the domestic population, and indeed the occupied population would have been outraged that they were allowing these violent neo-Nazis and white supremacists to go to the Middle East armed with an M16. I just wanted to go back. You were asking about the motives of people like Page. In my research, basically, white supremacists and neo-Nazi activists see the military as a way to gain military training courtesy of the U.S. taxpayer and to bring back to the United States and then start a domestic race war, which is called RAHOA. That's the terminology which is used in far-right circles. So this, it really does call into question the whole sort of pretext of the War on Terror. If the U.S. military, which we were told was trying to spread freedom and democracy in the Middle East, was sending these people that were basically wanting to arm themselves to start a domestic war in the United States, which Page shows can end up in some of the most horrendous massacres that the U.S. has seen.
So how would you detect whether an individual maybe has some sort of vaguely white supremacist affiliation and whether they're a card-carrying member of one of these groups that, as you say, wants to train in Iraq and then come home to begin a race war in the United States? How do you distinguish?
Well, there's lots of ways to do it. I mean, there's lots, and the U.S. military knew this was happening. It's not like this was an accident. They were being informed by the Southern Poverty Law Center, who released a long report in 2006. They were being informed by gang investigators themselves, Pentagon investigators, and active duty troops. All of them were telling the U.S. military during this period, look, this is a serious problem. We know you can't slow down because you've got two wars to fight, but you must, because this could be ending disaster for the domestic U.S. population and the occupied populations. I'll come to that in a minute. But the U.S. military did nothing about it. In fact, the whistleblowers on this issue were often ignored or targeted after they made their claims. I mean, I talked to a soldier called Jeffrey Stolson, who was a sergeant in Iraq, and he raised the alarm about rampant gang activity, and we can talk about that, but gangs was also another huge problem during the War on Terror. And he was demoted, and he was told his military career would be over. So there's many ways to detect white supremacist soldiers if the will is there. during the war on terror, the will wasn't there. And it seems, according to the experiences of that we've seen with Page, that during the 1990s, it wasn't there either. So,
all right, let's talk two things. So you've alluded to subcultures. I wonder how that plays out in the chain of command in the various services, if there is a white supremacist subculture or even gang subculture. And does the Pentagon have a position on whether they tolerate this sort of thing or whether they're actively pushing back on it? What's their statement here?
Yeah, well, the Pentagon, basically, their whole policy on white supremacists and neo-Nazis and gangs is reactive, i.e., something will happen, like the events of Sunday. There'll be a massacre or a murder, and they'll become embarrassed because the media and the American public will get up. Well, they'll be like, why are we training these crazy people who are coming back and killing our own people? The U.S. military will then put out a statement, we've tightened our regulations, we've changed it from inconsistent, i.e. extremism is inconsistent with military service, to prohibited, etc., etc. But, I mean, there's nothing unambiguous. And also, even there's two points to this. There's the regulations aren't tight enough, and even the ones that are in place aren't being enforced. So, I mean, if the will was there, they could get around this. In terms of future attacks in the United States, it might already be too late because they spent 10 years training some of the most violent people in the United States. That's the scary thing. I mean, we were talking about whistleblowers earlier. Daryl Johnson was an analyst for the Department of Homeland Security. He released a report in 2009 saying that what keeps him up at night is the thought of a far-right extremist carrying out a terrorist attack. And what did the DHS do to him? They moved him out of his job and basically shunned him. And that is a pattern that was seen all through the war on terror.
Describe the subculture again. I mean, are there units within the Army, Air Force, Marines, and Navy that might be fully affiliated throughout the chain of command? Or this is a series of one-offs who may be the odd person out in a particular unit, and they may notice a tattoo or hear a strong opinion, but that's the extent of it.
I think it's both. I mean, there was last year, it didn't get as much press coverage as it should have, but there was a picture released on the internet of a 10-strong scout sniper unit in Sangin, Afghanistan, posing with an American flag and SS Nazi bolts, which, I mean, should have raised massive alarms. As well as that, in the testimony I got from veterans, they would say maybe the command weren't, I mean, whole units weren't neo-Nazi units, but the command knew about individual soldiers and did nothing about it. And in fact, another interesting point is that neo-Nazi veterans that I talked to, some of them said that they were feted because they were seen as more warlike, i.e. they'd be told to go on the hardest missions because obviously they're the most violent and reckless people in the units. So, I mean, I don't know. I don't have any evidence of whole units belonging to neo-Nazi or white supremacist groups. I do have evidence that there was whole units that were infiltrated by gangs. That's without doubt.
All right. Matthew Kennard is author of the forthcoming book, Irregular Army, How the U.S. Military Recruited Neo-Nazis, Gang Members, and Criminals to Fight in the War on Terror. We should note that Wade Michael Page is not a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan and does not fall into the category that was most investigated by Matthew Kennard. Clearly, he was tolerated and spent years in the U.S. Army. Matthew, thanks so much.
All right, thanks.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.